Yeah, hi, I'm Robert, I'm an addict. Yeah, nice to be here. I love drugs. What can I tell you? I did. They worked for me for a long, long, long time, all right? I have to say that, all right? Okay, my drug history, I'll do a brief one for you. I started drinking when I was 9, I started popping pills when I was 12, and by 14 I was skin popping mephedrine, which you now call crystal meth. So that was my early drug history. By the age of 17 I was taking heroin on a daily basis, and that was the reality of it. I grew up in Notting Hill. I grew up in a council flat. I grew up with absolutely nothing. I remember looking up very early in my life, looking up at these 10-story blocks. They were the first high-rises in Notting Hill. And I remember looking up at them and thinking, what the hell am I doing here? I should be in Buckingham Palace or the White House, you know, and here I am in Henry Dickens Court. What's going on here? So someone didn't give me the script, you know, I've been missed out. And I felt like that until I came into recovery, and probably until I was probably 5 years clean in this program. I always felt as if I was on the outside of whatever side there was. I was never part of anything. Didn't matter whether I was in a street gang, a hippie festival or whatever. I was always separate and different. I always felt alone. I think that's the right word. Alone. Yeah, you know about that feeling? Alone. And I carried that feeling with me. You know, basically, I never went to school. Basically, people used to come to my door to take me to school, and I would smoke two or three joints before I even got to Holland Park. And, you know, during my time at Holland Park, I helped sort of turn on most of the people who went there, you know. And that was what we did in those days. You know, I mean, I grew up in the era of the 60s, and basically there were magazines like Oz and It and everything, and they all told us it was absolutely hip and correct to get stoned. That's what they told us. You know, it was hip and correct to get stoned. You know, we smoked joints. I got married in Richmond Park. I watched the sunset. You know, I mean, you know, all those things. I did all those hippie sort of things, you know, but then I veered off and went another way. You know, basically my using was really simple. My drug of choice was really simple one. I'll tell you what it was. More. Didn't matter what the drug I was taking, I couldn't get enough. And that was the reality of it. I just couldn't get enough. Yeah, I'll tell you a story. The lady who brought me into recovery, her name is Angie. She's now 36 years clean. I was living with her in Chelsea, and you know, we were selling a few drugs, that's all I would say to you. And this, just a few, yeah? Just a few. And this particular night, I was on a mission. And, you know, I used to, sorry to upset those who didn't take it, but I used to love shooting up heroin and cocaine. I used to love it. Okay? And this particular night, I was shooting up, I had bags of it, and I was shooting up heroin and cocaine. And every time I shot up, I would throw up this little bit of vomit on the floor, and I would move over and have another hit. That's what you do, isn't it? You have another hit. And by the end of the night, the whole of this sitting room in Paulson Square was covered with piles of sick. And I just went to bed, you know, that's what you do, isn't it? I just went to bed. I didn't even cross my mind that I should clear it up or whatever, you know. And I just went to bed. And the next morning, Angie's shaking me like this. What's happened? What's happened? There's sick all over. And we had a six-week-old kitten. I said, oh, it's the cat, yeah. Yeah, that was my, I'll give you an idea of my addiction. And there's someone here who I actually use with, and it's quite nice to see her here. Yeah, and I mean, we used together in a squat in Notting Hill, and that was in the 70s, and that's a long time ago. That is a long, long, long time ago. Yeah, I always remember the first person that I ever saw who I used with in here was Lionel Byn, quite a famous character. And that was the first person I ever saw in the rooms, and I'm sort of rushing ahead of myself there. Yeah, but I mean, I just used and I used and I used, and basically, the end of my using, basically, the best way I can explain it to you, I had 10 years in my life, complete blackout. And I mean, total, absolute blackout. And the only things I remembered was, sorry about my French, I got laid, I got beaten up, or I got busted. And that was it. That was the only way. I had 10 whole years of my life, which was complete blank. All right, just to give you an idea. I mean, I never took drugs. You know that, Emma, don't you? I never took a drug in my life. I'm a social worker. And basically, that was my experience. And I just couldn't get enough of whatever I was taking. And I tried. And, I was a hippie. And at the start of the punk thing, I went to the Roundhouse and I watched 999. And I was there with him. I was very cool. And I had a carnation in my white collarless jacket. I remember it. And I watched this 999. And then all these guys are bouncing up and down, spitting on the stage. And 999 was pouring beer all over them, and they loved it. And I thought, I can't be a part of this. This isn't for me. I'm sorry. So I didn't become a punk, all right? Just to tell you, I didn't become a punk, all right? But my addiction just went on. And I mean, basically, the thing I will say about my addiction was it got me into all the places I would have never got into any other way. You know what I mean? I've used with film stars, I will use with rock stars, I've done the whole host, and I mean, basically, that was through one reason and one reason only. That was I had drugs, no other reason. My addiction led me to a place where I believed I was God. All right? I was God. I really believed that. I believed I was God on earth. All right? That was what my addiction took me to. I used to walk down the streets of London at 4 o'clock in the morning, and I used to think, why aren't people getting out of their beds to watch me walk past? Yeah, and you want to know about self-obsession? Okay, you want to know about self-obsession? Okay, that's what I'm talking about. I'm talking about egoism gone mad. I got busted for trafficking in 1980. And basically what happened was I was at Knightsbridge Crown Court. And a certain judge, his name was Judge Friend, and his favourite expression in those days was, "My name is Judge Friend, and I'm no friend of yours." He wanted to, me to visit him at Knightsbridge Crown Court, and I didn't fancy that. Really did not fancy that, right? So I put myself into a place called Ashdown Ward, and I think in those days, there was only three detoxes in the whole of England. I'm pretty sure there was the Bethnal Royal, Ashdown, and there was another one scattered somewhere else. But and I put myself in. And in those days, the only way you got a detox was you had to actually sign yourself in under the Mental Health Act. So you're held in a lunatic asylum is where you're held, And basically, you know, we used to go and see them do the large actual shuffle and all that. You know, you used to walk down the corridors, and there used to be puddles, and you used to think, oh, it must be the roofs, and it wasn't the roofs, yeah? It wasn't the roofs. Yeah, and I mean, basically, and anyway, I came out of there. No, I went in there twice, actually. The second time I was in there. The second time I was in there, I was contacted by the lady I've already told you about. Her name is Angie. And she was working for the Charter as a nurse. She was working for the Charter Clinic as a nurse. And she told me I had a drug problem. And that I should maybe go to these meetings. And basically, bring the story back a bit. Prior to that, I had, around about that same sort of time, I didn't want to go into my groin. The only thing I had, the only enjoyment I had at the end of my using was sex. And basically, I wasn't going to go into my groin. You know, that was one thing I was not going to do. So I kept on skin popping bloody street drugs. And yeah, it's not a good idea, yeah? And the other thing is I was scripted on Dicanol. And basically, you know, I used to pick up my Dicanol script from a guy, a doctor off of North Pole Road. And basically, every time I picked up my script, I would ask him for an antibiotic prescription because I knew I was going to miss. Anyway, this particular time, my arm was like this. And, you know, I've had 4.5 ounces of pus taken out of my arm, just to give you an idea. You know, I mean, I've never used a drug, remember that. And this particular time, my arm was really swollen, and I went into accident emergency. I ended up in this doctor's office, and he just looked at my arm, and he got up, and he walked across the room, and he got a magic marker, and he drew a line on the top of my arm, and he said, if the poison goes above that line, I'm amputating your arm. Didn't even faze me, all right? Didn't even faze me. You want to know about insanity? Losing my arm didn't even faze me. Didn't even wake me up, basically. The same doctor came at me with one of those large green needles. You know those large green needles, yeah? And he said, I want some blood. And he took it out of my femoral. Anyway, I was diagnosed with something called alcoholic hepatitis, which nowadays is known as hepatitis C. And he told me, he said to me, really simple, he says, your liver is so swollen, he said, you've got one stage to go, you will die from cirrhosis of the liver, your liver will shrink to the size of a walnut and you will be dead. I'll give you no more than 3 months if you carry on using. Jane didn't faze me. Anyway, the same day that happened, I was walking along Lancaster Road in Ladbroke Grove, and I looked up like that, and there was a super attractive female at the top of this steps, and I recognised her, and I went running up the steps. And to give you an idea, by the end of my using, I was carrying my drugs in a carrier bag, or I'm in a carrier bag. You know, I was scripted on so many doctors, I used to have to keep a diary to remember the doctors I was scripted on. And you know, and I went round up and she just went like that. Anyway, bring the story on. That woman became my wife and the mother of my 3 children. Her name is Sarah and I love her very much, but I'm not in love with her. And she came into my life, and basically that was a real turning point for me, because what happened, I had no sanity in my life. I used to smoke joints together and all the rest of it, but she was sane. She would get up in the morning and go to work, and basically, you know, she was sane. She had this really super stable family around her, and all this normality, I suppose, is the best way. And she came into my life, and basically she worked for someone called John Frieda, and at that time John Frieda was the high highfalutin hairdresser in London. And basically she would come home and she would tell me stories of so and so. She'd give me those Daily Mail articles that you always get on Nostalgia. And basically she would say, he's got well, she's got well, blah, blah, blah. And slowly and slowly the seeds started to grow in my head. Anyway, so we went along to this meeting, it still goes this meeting, 1983 it was, went to this first meeting with my very attractive future wife, Sarah. I walked into this meeting, it's probably pretty much the same number as are here in there. And I looked around and I thought, they're all incredibly well-dressed. They're all very middle-class. You know, what the hell am I doing here? You know, and basically my first impression, I'll tell you now, you're going to laugh at this, my first impression of Narcotics Anonymous was that it was a dating agency for people who couldn't get laid. And that's the truth of it. I actually thought it was a dating agency for people who couldn't get laid, all right? I was very well, remember that. I was really sane when I got here. Anyway, they told me at that meeting to keep coming back, and that's all I did. And at that time, I think there was 5 meetings in the whole of England. And basically, in those days, as I used to go to meetings, and you know, I've never seen, in all my years of coming to meetings, I've never ever seen anyone get up and walk out and stash their drugs. Has anyone seen it? Well, I haven't. But has anyone seen it? Because I've never seen anyone do it. And I used to come in the meetings, and I used to walk in the meetings, and I used to row when I walked in. And they used to get up and walk to the other side of the room. And, you know, Johnny H., our founder member, had made friends with as soon as I came around. And, yeah, and I used to go up to him, and I used to go, what's that about? What's that about? And he just used to look at me straight in the eyes, and he used to go, they don't want to catch what you've got. Just keep coming back. And that's what I did. By a miracle, I got offered a place in the first treatment centre in Europe. And I went there. And basically, I've been here ever since. That's the reality of it. I've already told you I never worked. I sold drugs. That was my living, you know, so I made a living. I never worked. I had one CSC, a history in grade one in history. That was the only qualification I had. I had absolutely nothing and I came to these meetings. And last night I saw the guy who gave me my first job in recovery. And basically, he's still here. Just celebrated 33 years, and he gave me my first job in recovery. And I'll tell you the story of it. I went to this mansion in Hampstead, huge mansion, and I rang on the door, and his partner at that time opened the door, and he walked out, and he jumped into his Ferrari, and as he walked past me, he handed me this huge bunch of keys, which was the keys to this mansion. And to give you an idea, you know, he had a cinema screen the size of a wall, yeah? Do you understand me, in this house? And me, I'd never trusted myself. Someone had actually trusted me. And I was blown away by that. That was one of the real big parts of my early recovery. Anyway, I eventually got a job. Peter W. told me, did I want a job? I said, yeah, and I went in with a guy called Mike Lana, who was a minicab don, and he sat there and he said to me, can you sell? I said, it's a numbers game. The more you sell, the more you get. He said, you start on Monday, and that was my first job, and I did it for 25, 26 years, you know, a day at a time. And, you know, I went to meetings. The other thing I did very early on was I got involved in a thing called service. And basically, James, who's sometimes here, James and I basically, we started a meeting in that detox centre I was telling you about. It was called Ashdown. And it was on a Monday night, and we used to drive there right the way through South London and parts of Essex down to Bexley in Kent. And basically, we started this meeting. Anyway, I'm at a meeting, and Johnny came up to us and he says, H&I meeting, Wednesday night, you be there. I said, what are you talking about? I didn't even know. We had started a meeting and we didn't even know what H&I was. It was hospitals and institutions. I didn't even know what it was, but we had started a meeting. So that gives you a little bit of an idea. So all I did was, I woke up in the morning, I said my prayers. In those days, everyone used to smoke. I smoked cigarettes, I drank my coffee, go to work, end of work, I'd go to a meeting, go home and see my very beautiful wife. And you know, basically, it's a funny old thing, a recovery, isn't it? I'll give you an idea. No one ever discusses this thing called sex, do they, really? It's not one of the things we discuss. But, you know, I was 32 years of age when I came into recovery. And I had never, ever had sex without the aid of drinker drugs. All right? Never, ever in the whole of my life had sex without the aid of drinking drugs. And I can't remember the day it was, but I remember after coming out of that, coming back to London after being in Miracle Mansion, I remember walking under the subway, under the Euston Road, to the flat where I was living, knowing that Sarah would be waiting for me, and she de-virginated me. I lost my virginity. I lost my virginity, 32 years of age, all right? Could say I was a slow start, couldn't you, yeah? But it's a story, you know, people don't tell stories like that. World Convention, 1986, Wembley Conference Centre. Basically, at that time, fellowship is very, very small. It's probably 50% Jewish because they had money, and basically in those days they were charging a lot of money for people to get clean. And basically the fellowship was pure, absolute white. It was pure white, yeah, this fellowship. A few of us realised there was something wrong here. Anyway, Desmond, who normally comes here, basically, he was working for a law firm who had defended the Birmingham Six. And basically, they were defending someone called Frank Critchlow. Well, Frank Critchlow was the main man for the mangrove on All Saints Road. And basically, Desmond introduced us. And basically, on this particular day, we all met up at Labrogrove Tube Station. Bob B, any of you know who Bob B is? Well, he was the cleanest man in the world until he died last year. I think he had 51 years when he died. Bob B and several other fellas turned up and we all walked up. And we walked up the road, and in those days, All Saints Road was the original front line. There was 500 boys on the street, all right? 500 boys on the street. And we walked up, and they said, "You're here to see Frank," and it just moved like a wave like that, and they let us through, and we went in. And I went into the mangrove, and basically I heard sharing. I've never heard sharing like it. You know, Bob B's story in the Blue Book is, "I found the only NA meeting in the world." You guess what he did before he went to that meeting? He sent his wife to check it out. Yeah, to give you an idea, you know, his story is, "I found the only NA meeting," but he didn't trust it that much. He sent his wife to chuck it out before he went there, you know. Anyway, and, you know, from that, they gave us a room in the mangrove. They didn't charge us. There was no charge for it. They gave us a room in the mangrove, and basically from that situation, I'm not going to say their names, various people came into the rooms and they threw chairs on the floor. They called us every name under the sun, and basically they were seriously hostile, but they kept on coming back. And some of those, one of those I now know is about 26 or 27 years clean. And the fellowship grew. As I said, you know, when I came around, there were five meetings, and I've been privileged in this program to actually watch this program, this fellowship grow. And, you know, this little blue book, just to give you an idea, the madness of Narcotics Anonymous. Narcotics Anonymous and I are exactly the same age, all right? We're exactly the same age, me and Narcotics Anonymous. And do you realize that it took them 30 years to publish that book? That's how long it took Narcotics Anonymous to publish that book. 30 years. So for 30 years, Narcotics Anonymous survived without having a big book. And what happened, and I remember, they published that blue book, and what happened is the fellowship exploded. It exploded. Suddenly there were meetings springing up all over the place, all over the world. There were meetings, fellowships were starting, and basically that came from the publication of that simple book. Service. Let's talk about a little bit about service. I've always been involved in this program. I've always gone to meetings. I've hated you at times, I've loathed you at times, I've loved you at times, but the bottom line of it, I've always kept on coming back. That's what I've always done. My message has always been really simple. I've always kept coming back. And I've come back for one simple reason. I'll tell you what my reason is. I don't want to die, all right? And today's a good day to die for me. I don't have a problem with dying, that's not the problem. But I come here because, for me, what this fellowship represents more than anything is life. That's what this fellowship gives me. Gives me life. I look into your faces and basically I know that I'm alive. You know, you're all like mirrors to me. You know, I look into you and I see me. That's the reality of it. And all I do is I've been involved in this fellowship. I did, you know, I mean, I took a meeting in Wormwood Scrubs. I blow my own trumpet. I took it for 9 years. And do you want to know my insanity? I'm just about to do security clearance to go and do it again. But there you go. The reason I like prison service, should I say the reason why I like prison service? They let me out. Okay, they let me out. And I was reading something in the Evening Standard about knife crime. And, you know, I watched these fathers and these people who have been stabbed and they're on life support. You know, I used to carry a knife when I was on the street. You hear me? I used to carry a knife. So it is by the grace of God and my own luck that I'm not sitting in a cell facing a life sentence, yeah? Okay? That's the reality of it. Okay, I've always been involved in service. So for anyone, please, please get involved. It's a really nice way of carrying the message. The steps, okay. For me, the steps are quite simple. The first one is about one thing and one thing only. It's about self-honesty. I can lie to whoever I want, but the most important thing is I don't lie to myself. That is the reality of step one for me. It's about self-honesty. Two is what this program, what people always talk about. It's about a wonderful principle called hope. Hope. That's what we get here. You get given the message, you don't have to do that anymore. Keep coming back. And that's hope. The third one, which was I found very, very difficult to get my head around, is action. No one in here will keep us clean apart from ourselves. The only person who's going to ever make anyone use is ourselves. So it's action. The fourth is a lovely principle. It's called courage. And you hear people screaming about their step fours. Well, just remember, the principle for step four is courage. The fifth is an interesting one. It's called integrity. And integrity is basically completeness and knowing ourselves the way we are and accepting ourselves. I have a whole meditation every morning where I love and accept myself the way I am, and I'm very grateful for it, all right? Because I now know I love and accept myself the way I am. You know, I break off from the steps, it's boring, isn't it? saves our lives, though, that's the reality. You know, I had someone, a couple of stories about Trafalgar Square. I had someone come up to me in this meeting, and he said to me, "You used to sell me drugs." You know, you can guess what I said to him. "No way, go away." Anyway, he gave me the name of the person I was living with and the street name of where I was busted. Anyway, so it's a funny old thing how things happen in this. Another guy I met here, he came here, he was 30 days clean, and he recognized me from that meeting that I told you about in Ashdown Ward. And he had stayed clean in Ashdown Ward and getting out of there for 6 months and then basically had used. And I suppose he had been using for 26, 27 years. And he came to this meeting, this Trafalgar Square. Guess what? He recognized me. Don't ask me how, but he did. And he's still clean to this day. Yeah. So what can I tell you about it? You know, basically join us, please. This program works. You know, the reality of it is, you know, if I was a drug doctor, you know what I would do? I would chop off all the addicts' heads for the first 5 years that they were clean and then give them back when they were 5 years clean. And I think a few more people might actually survive, yeah? Do you hear me? Yeah, I mean, people are forever coming up to me going, "Will you sponsor me? Will you sponsor me?" The thing is, I never hear from them again. I ring them up and they go, "Oh, I've got a new sponsor," or whatever. I never hear from them again. They go, "Will you sponsor me?" "Yeah, sure, yeah," I never hear from them. Charlie's laughing. It's true though, Charlie, isn't it? "Will you sponsor me?" Yeah. I mean, all I've done in this program is three simple things. I'll tell you what they are. The first one is very, very important. And remember, you know, I've been clear from Hep C for a long time now, but my liver is still very, very, I'm cirrhosed. My liver is still cirrhosed. It will always be cirrhosed. You know, and I mean, I've had people standing over me with knives, and I've raised my leg like that, and they've gone, "That is pathetic," and they walked out the room. You know, I mean, I've been below stabbing at times, yeah? All right, just, okay, you want to know of me as a hero? Okay. I was below stabbing, and that's true. That's true, all right? Yeah, I've been shot. I've had people coming at me from both sides of the rooms with butcher's knives. But I haven't done, but one thing I haven't done in this program, I haven't died, all right? I haven't died, and for that I'm eternally grateful. The second one is I haven't used, and that's the reality of it, I haven't used. And the third one, you know what the third one is? I've kept on coming back. Regardless of anything, I've kept on coming back. That's all I've ever done. I've kept on coming back to these meetings. And I've stayed involved. And what I try to do more than anything in my life is I try to carry a message and reach out my hand. Funny thing, let's do a little exercise here. Reach out. "Hi, I'm Robert."
"Hi."
Hi. Try it.
Hi,
no one wants to try it. You see what I mean? You're all feared up. Come on, man. But am I wrong? Am I wrong? Everyone sits there like this. Everyone sits there like this. Whenever I sit down in a meeting, I always reach out my hand. I go, I'm Robert. All right? I always do that. Okay. Shelley's going to scream at me in a minute and to shut up. So I will close. I will tell you this. His name was Andre. He was a little old Irish man. And give you an idea of his rock bottom. He used to go in with a pair of shoes for a drink and put a pair of shoes on the bar for a pair of drinks, and they knighted him off. And he was 12-step by H&I of our mother fellowship, and he never drank again. Anyway, he used to say this: when a man or woman walks into the rooms of Narcotics Anonymous, the heavens fall silent and God listens, because the dignity of a human being is about to be restored. Thank you.